Ah, the Vampire Counts. There's no one quite like them in Warhammer. There's plenty like them over in Vampire the Masquerade, but we're not worrying about that right now. The undead masters of the night, who prowl in the darkness upon unsuspecting people to do quite the large variety of nasty things to. Drink their blood, slaughter them, turn them into zombies, all three. The possibilities are as endless as the night, and they come in all sorts of fun flavors, too. The vampires of Warhammer aren't just vampires, no. That's far too simple a description that leaves all sorts of nuance unsaid. And it would probably get you butchered if you told a vampire that they're all the same thing, because in terms of insulting them, that's right up there with flashing a symbol of Sigmar in their face. Worse, since at least that one has Sigmar's backing behind it. You can have mad wizards in towers doing maniacal research, noble aristocrats of the night that only occasionally go into a blood rage, and feral maniacs that are always in a blood rage. These and more make up the vampires of Warhammer. They're as varied as they are bloodthirsty, and they're bloodthirsty in more ways than one. While unfortunately the vampire counts are still relegated to legends in the old world, there's no reason not to talk about them a bit. So tonight, make sure to do the classic sprint to your room when you turn off the lights for the evening, because you never truly know when a member of the Midnight Aristocracy is waiting to strike. But while vampires don't need to sleep at night, you most certainly do. It's the most important part of the day. And for the best sleep experience possible, you can do no better than Helix, the sponsor of this video. Helix makes mattresses, but not just any mattresses. Helix makes premium mattresses, custom-made to give you the best sleep possible, and they're delivered right to your door to boot. There's over 20 unique options, including the award-winning Lux mattresses I can personally attest to, and the premium Elite collections. There's also Helix Plus for those of us who need some extra room, and the Helix Kids mattress, because little Timmy deserves a good night's rest too. How you find one is easy as can be, and really cuts down on any choice paralysis you might be feeling looking at a massive catalog of mattresses. You just need to take the Helix sleep quiz, and once you're done, it matches you with one tailored to your needs. I ended up getting the Helix Midnight Lux, and it's been phenomenal. I've had it for about 8 months now, and I've never appreciated a mattress more than with this bad boy. It's the perfect level of firmness, and I always look forward to lying down, be it to read for a bit or for the best time of the day. Bedtime. With setup as easy as taking it out of the box and unrolling it, there's not even any hassle involved in getting it through any doors like a Three Stooges bit. And if you aren't completely sold yet, Helix has a 100-day sleep trial period to really make sure you love your new mattress. Combined with the 10-year warranty and flexible payment plans mean you can rest assured that Helix is not only confident you'll enjoy your mattress, but dedicated to making sure the experience of getting one is as smooth as possible. I love my Helix mattress, and I think you would too. If you're looking for a new bed, check out Helix. Their New Year's Final Hour sale is running now for a limited time, and it's a great time to upgrade your mattress. Visit helixsleep.com/pancreasnowork to get 25% off your mattress plus 2 free pillows. That's helixsleep.com/pancreasnowork for 25% off your mattress plus 2 free pillows. Sleep is the best time of the day, so get yourself a Helix mattress now to make it that much better. Now then, time to talk about the thirstiest people in all of Warhammer. The origins of the vampires of Warhammer are something that you could probably guess at even with minimal knowledge of the setting. The world's biggest dick weasel, known as Nagash. Nagash, in his various escapades to ruin everything around him, at one point created an elixir of eternal life. Contrary to what I just said, however, this was not the exact beginning of vampirism, though it was certainly the precursor. Though it bound them to his will in no small part because none of them could recreate it, this potion allowed his lieutenants to gain, of course, eternal life, as well as incredible strength. It allowed them a crucial edge over their uncorrupted kin, helping them and Nagash take the fight to their enemies. It wasn't quite enough to stop them from getting defeated, but this was before Nagash was powerful enough to just become an entire Winds of Magic, and their enemies consisted of all of Nehekara. A little bit of canon conflict happens with older and newer lore, but not enough to totally destroy continuity by any means. For example, in the book series about Nagash's rise to power, Arkhan was forced to recreate the Elixir of Life for the Court of Lamia. In other places, including the End Times, he had been dead for a while by the time that nonsense rolled around. Ignoring that, it was otherwise someone named Wasoran who was responsible for these actions. After Nagash's defeat, some of his followers were taken to the city of Lamia to be interrogated. In addition, some mortuary cult priests who had served him spread out across Nehekara in the guise of being banished, and were happily accepted into those places where they went. Wasoran was one such individual, and it was indeed he who helped corrupt Neferata with the knowledge of Nagash. With her already being curious for such things, Wasoran basically just had to give her a gentle nudge in the right direction for the pair to get to work attempting to recreate Nagash's elixir of life for themselves and improve it. And with the efforts of these two figures that would become the stuff of legend, they managed to create the elixir from Wish. See, the thing with the original elixir that separated its effects from vampirism was that it didn't really have too much in the way of downsides. Sure, it bound you to Nagash, which is a very big one, but that was really it. No curses, no being burned by sunlight, none of that stuff. But Neferata's version turns you into a nocturnal, blood-sucking parasite, a true vampire. Of course, the immense power and immortality also came along with it, and so when she became the first vampire, she convinced numerous others to drink it as well, with Soren, of course, being one of the first to partake. Ironically enough, it actually created a sort of super-immortality, since it apparently draws the human soul fully inside the body where gods and demons can't grab it to corrupt or take. I guess in Warhammer Fantasy, bits of your soul just hang around your outsides. They call themselves Trueborn, by the way, but they're vampires. Let's just call them what they are. With vampirism now a thing, they quickly set about taking over Lamia. Initially, this was done quietly and to great success. Neferata made it a decree that vampires were not to fight other vampires, and at first they only ever fed on the blood of those that wouldn't be missed by society at large. Criminals, prisoners of war, and probably the occasional homeless person who chose the wrong alley to sleep in for the night. But after a while, things started breaking down. Neferata and the other vampires' curious trait of seeming to not age a day was of course a telltale sign something was afoot, but the mortuary cult was already working on such things as well, so that wasn't too much of an alarm going off. Vampire rivalries beginning to break out also didn't help matters, but again, this was mostly kept in check. The hundreds of slaves a night that were feasted upon, as well as the statues of Nagash and the seeming worship of him as a god, now that was a bit harder to ignore and play off. The final domino would come in the form of Alkadizar, the last great king of Nehekara. Last king, period, for that matter. Spoiler alert. Neferata tried to make him her perfect boy toy, including giving him some of that vampiric sippy sip. He then ran off and managed to truly uncover the Lamian's doings to the rest of Nehekara. After a little bit of a holy war against the vampires of Lamia were either cast out or killed to a man. Neferata trying to forcibly turn her cousin Kalida, who then had the goddess Asaf kill her so she couldn't be turned, also probably didn't help matters much either. Although any witnesses were silenced not long after that little duel, so that was just kind of a sign of things breaking down in general rather than the straw that broke the camel's back, I guess. The vampires would then flee, spreading out across the land like the world's worst rash. Eventually they would fall under the return Nagash's control, and with him striking out to retake Nehekara again, they would be the commanders of his legion. They were all fully aware he didn't give a single solitary ounce of shit about them, but Nagash is the kind of leader that's really hard to pull a Starscream on, so they stayed largely loyal. Plus, they were magically bound to his will, further forcing them into servitude. For years, the vampires would then plague Nehekara under Nagash's command, but they could never gain dominance or reclaim Lamia like they so craved. Alkadizar's armies were hard-pressed initially, but would eventually turn things around somewhat. All this time, the vampires continued their plotting in the background because they're real pricks like that. The vampire Vasha Nesh, who may also very well be Vlad von Karstein, allowed himself to be killed by Alkadizar to free themselves from Nagash's grip. The vampires and Nagash were driven off, but only temporarily. Round 2 comes about, Nagash casts Power Word Kill on all of Nehekara except for Alkadizar, Alkadizar and some rats kill Nagash, and now the vampires kind of have to figure out what the hell to do with themselves. Out of the original Trueborn vampires, only a few remain. And they couldn't stay in Nehekara any longer. The now undead Tomb Kings would be all too happy to get some payback on them, and of course there was the more practical problem of there no longer being any food in Nehekara. It is very difficult to draw blood from a skeleton, as it turns out. This time period was known as the Diaspora, and the vampires spread out across the world. Some of them would do their best to blend in with the living, quietly taking blood from those whose cities they had slipped into. Others formed empires such as that of Strigos, which was co-opted by Usharan and destroyed by Neferata, who, by the way, they're related, which makes this even more of a dick move. There's also, of course, the, in my opinion, greatest vampire empire of Luthor Harkon of the Vampire Coast. And of course, Vlad von Karstein took Isabella as his wife, and together they ruled over the imperial province of Sylvania, although that one is jumping ahead in the timeline a bit, as there's still some stuff left to cover. When Nagash returned to the time of Sigmar, he once again tried to assert control over the vampires to force them to become his lieutenants. In essence, they told him to fuck off, and since Nagash decided to declare war on the Hammer God himself, he naturally lost. Little did the vampires know, though, that this was to bite them in the ass arguably harder than anything before then, because Nagash, despite being defeated, was powerful enough and still had enough influence over the undead to throw the mother of all hissy fits for their betrayal. Every random thing that came to his mind, he cursed them with. We weakness to sunlight, weakness to Sigmar and symbols of him, being allergic to garlic. If you can think of a classic vampire weakness, chances are they have it in Warhammer because it's one of the random things that came to Nagash's unbelievably petty mind when he was cursing them. The only exceptions are, of course, the need to feed on blood, and maybe the whole weakness to sunlight thing. That could have been the god Petra cursing them, or it could have been a weakness inherent in Neferata's elixir that carried down to the rest of the vampires after the first Trueborn. I choose to believe that Nagash still did it, though, because him just deciding everyone has lost sun privileges is very on-brand for the guy. Before we get to the types of vampires, there's some general stuff about vampirism as a whole that should be gone over. First off, becoming a vampire doesn't instantly lock you in as someone who's evil and wants to rule the lands of the living in eternal night. Your alignment doesn't automatically shift to evil the moment your heart stops, but what does happen is your personality gets a bit amplified. If you're an overall decent person who does their best to help their community and donate to those in need, you turn into a saint. The problem of most vampires being evil largely comes from the people who get turned into vampires, and just some things about people in general. For that second part, I mostly mean how people don't want to die, and as a vampire, you now have to drink blood. Honorably not doing so to avoid plaguing the world is certainly noble, but it's easier said than done to essentially force yourself to commit suicide by starvation. For the first part, most vampires aren't going around turning people that are saintly do-gooders. They're giving the blood kiss to people who they think would make good vampire underlings, which usually means power-hungry assholes. This isn't always the case, such as with Ulrika, but she is an example of what I first talked about. When she was turned, she debated just letting herself be killed, but survival instincts are pretty hard to put aside, and she couldn't let it happen. The flip side of the personality bit is true as well. A person who's got a bit of a mean streak is now the world's greatest asshole. It also gives vampires a bit more of a propensity to use violence, although not necessarily by making them monsters. It just makes you largely immune to being shocked and terrified by blood and gore. For one final reason that vampires are often awful, the initial feeding frenzy most of them go through when they first turn also makes them more likely to cross the moral event horizon, since it tends to leave a lot of casualties behind. If you've already killed 50 people in your blood rage because you were just so hungry, you might as well make it a nice clean 100. There are, nevertheless, hundreds of vampires living largely peaceful lives amongst mortals, be it by doing what the initial Lamians did and only going for prisoners and criminals, or by methods such as animal blood and deals with willing people. These vampires aren't looked positively upon by either their kin or witch hunters, so they have to lay low more so than most vampires already do. Also worth noting is that humans aren't necessarily the only beings that can become vampires, it's just that the other races often have some form of protection against it that humans don't. The High Elf Aldaira, for example, became a vampire in the End Times, although admittedly this was sort of all over the place, and she might not have actually been a vampire, but simply surrounded by death magic because she was being tutored to become the next elven goddess of the dead. Or alternatively, GW after the Nagash End Times book simply stopped caring about writing things well, and that's why it could be either. But aside from that, with the elves, they're so magically inclined they can usually detect any bloodsuckers in their midst, while the dwarf's innate resistance to magic helps them avoid it as well. Again though, nothing is impossible, and if nothing else, the idea could be plenty fun for a Warhammer Fantasy roleplay campaign. There is of course also the matter of chaos to consider when looking at vampires. For the most part, they are, as with the rest of the undead, highly resistant to it. Most vampires tend to be arrogant bastards and will refuse to serve the Chaos God, so on that front there's little in the way of temptation to be found. It can happen, a large group of blood dragons were turned to corn during the End Times, but it rarely does. As for just being physically corrupted, it again can happen, but is far less likely than if you or I just walked into a portal to the realm of chaos and hoped for the best. Undead are inherently resistant to chaos because they spit in the face of the laws of the material world and the immaterial. They're beings of magic, like demons, but orderly and resistant to change, unlike demons. Pulling from a bit of AOS stuff for the sake of the argument, if you leave a vampire in the realm of chaos for thousands of years, then yeah, they'll probably come out a little bit funky, like what the Osiarch Fortress and Archaon's front lawn is suffering from. But they'll still handle it a hell of a lot better than most people would. There's also some mention that they aren't big fans of Warpstone, but again, neither are normal people. If you aren't a Skaven, that stuff is horror to you, so I'm hardly gonna count that as a weakness specific to vampires. It's like saying someone is weak to being irradiated from exposure to enriched uranium. That applies to everyone ever, that isn't unique to any one person in particular. Another perk vampires get is a natural affinity for necromancy and dark magic. Most vampires will be at least passingly acceptable at raising a few dozen corpses to throw at you, and of course the greatest of vampires lead armies of the dead in the tens, if not hundreds of thousands. Combine this with their incredible strength, and there's very few things that can hold back a vampire army when it's properly going to war. The other side of that coin is that they're the ones holding the army together in a very literal manner. Since they're the ones supplying the magic keeping the army together, when they die, there's a good chance the dead under their command will just drop with them, and they'll certainly lose any sense of cohesion. Necromancers can make up for this and take some of the strain off their overlords, but even then, if the commanding vampire is defeated, the army isn't far behind them. For the last bit of generalities to cover, there's a few traits all vampires share. I am going to, in the future, call certain bloodlines more frail and less suited for direct combat. Please keep in mind that this is strictly in comparison to other vampires, because even the most desiccated-looking Necrarch can rip a man in half with little effort. The weaknesses of the vampire are also by no means universal. Sometimes, just making the sign of the hammer and praying to Sigmar will cause a vampire to combust on the spot. Sigmar doesn't even need to actually intervene himself, simply invoking him will do the trick. Other times, they can waltz right into a temple of Sigmar and feel only mildly uncomfortable, such as is shown in the Matthias Thulemann novels. Same deal with the sun. Sometimes vampires immediately light on fire, while others will just be sluggish and tired. Garlic might be helpful at warding them off, but there's also some heavy hints that this is a rumor propagated by vampires so that ignorant peasants are easier to feast upon. Alright, now I think it's time to actually talk about the bloodlines. There's 5 major ones, each vastly distinct from one another. Their origins come from one of the original true-born vampires in the olden days, although how pure their blood is varies from vamp to vamp. Since the founders are largely still around in some capacity, if they turn a new vampire, that one's blood is going to be purely of that bloodline. Congratulations, lady who was given special attention by Neferata, you're now a full-fledged Lamian. But over time, the various bloods were spread around a little bit. Sometimes it was through some classic forbidden love, where two vampires with differing bloodlines were so enthralled with each other they shared blood, and any future vampires they each made were a mix of both. Of course, usually it was through violence. A von Karstein kills and drinks from a Necrarch, so now their children will mostly be von Karstein in lineage, but there's a little bit of Necrarch hanging around. This partially explains why some vampires are merely annoyed by X weakness, while others are crippled or outright killed by it, even among shared bloodlines. The mixing of blood basically spins a wheel for what vampiric weaknesses are going to be prominent in a newly made one. In terms of facing one, that means knowing the most prominent bloodline of a vampire will only tell you what they'll most likely be like. They can have all sorts of nasty, unexpected tricks up their sleeve due to some convoluted lineages on their part. These bloodlines rarely work with each other. Vampires are already incredibly vain and arrogant, so getting two vamps of the same bloodline to work together already takes some hard work. Getting vampires of differing bloodlines to work together is damn near impossible. Nobody likes the Strigoi, for instance. The Lamians aren't exactly popular either, because they're a bunch of sneaky gits who stick their noses where it doesn't belong and manipulate mortals against other vampires. First up, we'll go over the poster boy bloodline, the Von Karsteins. Feel free to capitalize or not the V in the Von, but if you say Von Karstein, I'm gonna throw you into a Vargeist's lair. Although funnily enough, an old roleplay supplement mentions how it really pisses Manfred off when you pronounce it Karstein. So in that singular instance, feel free to say it that way. The Von Karsteins are the classical Dracula bloodline. They want to rule the night and suck your blood, and while this is an unsubstantiated rumor, there's evidence to suggest they love teaching children how to count. Their founder was Vashanesh, also known as Ankhat, also known as Vlad von Karstein, also known as the origins of the vampires and Vlad have been through more retcons than anyone else in Warhammer. Please God, why? Make the lore changes stop. Vashanesh was once Neferata's husband after she deposed her brother once she became a vampire. Or Vashanesh never existed, and he was instead Ankhat, who was a political ally of Neferata turned vampire. Or Vashanesh did exist, but it was Arkhan there. Or Arkhan wasn't there, and it was Wasoran, and Neferata only ever loved Arkhan. Or alternatively, just decide which lore you like is canon, because who cares? Who cares? Everything goes. Theoretically, the Vashanesh story was one he just made up to look good compared to Neferata, but also in the end times, the Vashanesh story was presented in the army book, but the novel went with the Ankhat version. I'm done caring. Figure it out yourself. Vlad sure was a vampire at this time, then the living defeated Neferata, then Nagash came back and turned everyone into skeletons, then he lost, and then all the vampires went their separate ways after they yelled at each other for ruining everything. Vlad, and I am done calling him anything but Vlad, traveled all over the world for a bit. He was an advisor to the Dragon Emperor himself, apparently, helping them drive back the Chaos Raiders that attack the Great Bastion every 5 seconds. It was then revealed he was a vampire, so he decided to be a pirate for a while after that. Warsaran found him eventually, they fought, and then they went their separate ways. Eventually, Vlad made his way to Sylvania, married his wife Isabella, turned her into a vampire, and then wife guy and husband lady would rule the province. The province was such a dump that despite being vampires, they made it noticeably better to live in. Eventually, the secret that they were undead broke free, and Vlad decided that simply being the Lord of Sylvania wasn't enough. After all, who better to become emperor than a man who would never die? He failed, as did the vampiric children Conrad and Manfred later on, but the damage was already done. The Blood Kiss was granted to hundreds, and while they went through ups and downs in their power, the Von Karstein bloodline had spread across the empire, concentrated largely in Sylvania, of course. The Von Karsteins are in the fashion of Dracula, handsome, arrogant, and believing themselves to be the true rulers of the night. They have a vested interest in Sigmar's realm, believing themselves to be the true rulers of it in particular. Of course, were they to take the throne, they would absolutely look outwards, for their arrogance is unmatched amongst even their kin and other bloodlines. They believe that their noble blood makes them the rightful rulers of everything, which is curiously contrasted by how they give the blood kiss freely to damn near anyone who asks, at least compared to how other bloodlines give it out. To counteract the fact that this sometimes creates people like Conrad von Karstein, of whom all you need to know about him is that he's a Warhammer character with a name Conrad, they tend to engage in internal politicking to the point of insanity. In fact, you can summarize the Von Karsteins pretty easily by thinking them of a parody of nobility in every way. They don't just throw a feast, they invite every single person they know to the finest dining experience ever conceived. They don't just have a grudge with another noble family, they swear an oath to tear them down and all of their holdings until history forgets they ever existed. They live in crumbling castles tended to by zombie and skeleton servants, and when not attacking mankind, they spend their hours attacking each other in dynastic politics gone mad. The Von Karsteins are, at least in my opinion, somewhat of the generalist vampire faction. You could make an excuse for pretty much any kind of army or attitude to be depicted with them. They're all handsome and charismatic, letting them sway mortals to their side without bloodshed. Their arrogance and desire for command is so powerful that you can expect plenty of tame beast being their armies as well, from animals like wolves and bats to mutated vampires like Vargeist. And of course, endless legions of the dead. They were the main antagonists of the vampire wars after all, and what sort of proper general doesn't have an endless army of zombies? The Von Karsteins overall are the ones you want if you either want the most stereotypical of vampires, the most noble and blue-blooded ones, or if you're indecisive. And as much as two of those things sound dismissive, the classics are classics for a reason, and really, those damn Sigmarites could use the humbling that the grave brings. Next up are the Lamians. The Lamians descend from Neferata, the first vampire. While the Von Karsteins are a grab bag of every vampire trope ever, the Lamians lean all the way into the sex appeal of vampires. Not in the weird, sparkly way, though. They're also the vampire Illuminati, which is what's led them to be probably the second most despised bloodlines amongst vampires behind the poor Strigoi. After the fall of Lamia proper, Neferata and some of her remaining underlings pretended to be wise seers and prophets amongst some tribes of men. After enough time and power was gained, she took the dwarf hold of Silver Pinnacle to use as a base of operations, which was indeed one of the first time contact was established between vampires and dwarfs. It's one of the reasons the dwarfs tend not to like them very much, beyond them being abominations against the natural order, of course. There was naturally infighting amongst her bloodline too, but it was much less frequent compared to the Von Karsteins going at each other every 5 minutes. Some Lamians did want immediate power over men compared to Neferata's plans that would take thousands of years to get anywhere. Those vampires shacked up in Kislev and were actually cast down, proving the Illuminati thing was the way to go, but there's of course a small number of them that still want to do things this way and refuse to work with the rest of the Lamians. Sometimes a Lamian will also go a bit too native and fall in love with the target they're supposed to just be seducing for Neferata's schemes, and they're hunted down as well as the first group. These ones aren't, however, done gleefully, both because the Lamians don't enjoy infighting all that much and because no one wants to break up the Forbidden Lovers. It's just not a fun experience. Aside from these rogues, though, Lamian vampires are unique in that they have a pretty centralized command structure. Neferata is, of course, at the top, and any newly born, lower-ranked vampires have to act on the orders of those above them. No enterprising Lamian should go off and perform some amazing power play to impress their masters. That sort of thing goes against protocol and is going to get you punished. Also rather unique for the Lamians, any potential new vampires are for the most part invited in and willingly joining the bloodline. They then go to the Silver Pinnacle to be taught the ways of the Lamian operation. How to seduce people, magically and traditionally, the various methods they take to remain hidden, all that good stuff. From there, rather than proceeding to dwell in a castle and darkly brood over an army of zombies, they instead live amongst the cities of man. With a vast amount of wealth the Lamians have gathered, as well as them pretending to be noble in a rather more low-key way than the Von Karsteins, the Lamians have by and large found the perfect cover for their actions. Nobility tends to be a bit weird across the board, so who cares if your new countess has some weird habits? And getting up early is for the common folk. Half the time nobles are already staying up till midnight before they have dinner, so who cares if one of them does it all the time? And so what if your new baroness has some awfully pale skin? Working the fields and getting tan is peasant behavior. It's perfectly understandable she'd avoid the sun. Some Lamians, however, do stay by Neferata's side, helping to educate the younger vampires in their ways. And the truly favored ones get the highest of honors in Lamian society. Tending to Neferata's cats. Turns out Neferata's own brand of insanity is being a crazy cat lady. Who'da thunk it? Poor Neferata. After Kalida turned her down, she never found another fish in the sea. That and Arkan doesn't really have anything down there to work with. His boners are a tad bit too literal. The bloodline is often called the Lamian Sisterhood, since it is overwhelmingly female, although some male Lamians do exist. They tend to be looked down upon by their fellow kin and are never considered true members of the Sisterhood, but there have been plenty of female officials in the various offices of the Empire and other nations, so a few men are good to have to hand. Plus, you never know when an Elector Count might be batting for the other team, as it were, so it's good to have some sexy men around with a sexy woman for when you need them. The overall goal of the Sisterhood is somewhat tame in comparison to the other vampires. Neferata wishes to regain control of Lamia and rule it with a new cult of blood like she started with, only now with her being the only focus of worship. When they have to take the battle, the first thing to try is getting an army of mortals to do their bidding instead. No small amount of wars against other vampire bloodlines have been started secretly by the Lamians informing their mortal underlings about the other vampires present. That's also largely how Neferata wages war against the Tomb Kings that control Lamia. If there's an expedition to steal stuff from Nehekara, there's a decent chance she funded it. If there's one to Lamia specifically, she almost certainly did. Kalida, however, is a smart mummy and knows damn well what Neferata wants. A Gotchik and Felix book actually revolves around one of Neferata's schemes to take the city, to which Kalida remarks in the most bored tone you've ever heard that the underling Neferata sent wasn't the first, won't be the last, and was hardly the most interesting one out of all the ones that try and kill her. This is also the book that a tomb queen says she would kill Felix through the hip-shattering sex they'd have if she wasn't a mummy, so the story is worth a read for that reason alone. When they do have to fight, they prefer to have skeletons as their main force for no other reason than those undead don't stink like hell. As for how they fight, it's pure dex build. They weave gracefully and quickly through combat, taking out their enemies quickly and efficiently with a single thrust of their dagger. This works against all sorts of enemies, both because of their intense training at the Silver Pinnacle and because they're still vampires and can punch through steel like it's papier-mâché. If they need to, they'll dip into the less aesthetic of the Vampire Count's rosters, but they prefer not to. Appearances must be upheld, after all. In their day-to-day lives, though, they're arguably the most benevolent bloodline to mortals. To remain hidden, they only really feed upon willing victims. There is absolutely a ton of mind control going on here, since with a glance a Lamian can put you under their spell, but they rarely outright kill the person, so there's at least that. And while it is for selfish reasons, they do still help get rid of the other vampire bloodlines in the area that are rather less polite than they are. Regardless of the reasoning, a Lamian getting another vampire killed is still one less vampire for mortals to worry about, and they help keep chaos out of a given area. Ruling mankind is meaningless if it then immediately falls to chaos, so they secretly help witch hunters find their quarry, which is something that's hard to fault no matter the motive. The influence of the Lamian Sisterhood is unmatched in its scale in the Warhammer world. Though their thralls may not be vampiric in nature, Neferata has plenty of influence in the lands of the elves and dwarfs. She knew of Aliathar being Tyrion's daughter and thus afflicted with the curse of Anarion before Manfred or Arkhan ever suspected. The going-ons of the Asur and Druki are of no secret to her, and for the most part, of little consequence. And though this paranoia is certainly helpful to their schemes, you really can never truly know who is and isn't a Lamian in the noble societies of mankind, not without testing it. And if you're wrong in your testing, you've just killed a nobleman, which tends to be frowned upon by the local authorities. Everyone from your friendly local innkeeper and the tavern maids to the new noblewoman who just moved in may secretly be a Lamian and their entourage in disguise. But there's no need to fear. As long as you do what they say and just play nice, they'll make sure everything's okay. You don't need to worry your little head about a single thing. Feel free to imagine a dominant Lamian vampire before you go to bed tonight. That mental image is on the house. Our next bloodline is the Nekrark. Their founder was Wasoran, that cunning bastard who probably, maybe helped Neferata concoct her vampire potion. Their whole thing is being all about knowledge at all costs. When a great library they had burned down, their lust for knowledge was so great that many of them let themselves burn with it, either unwilling or so compelled by the contents within, unable to leave. They're also one of two bloodlines that have figured out how to avoid having to drink blood to survive. This was discovered after Wasoran wrote a cool magical book that, in addition to the knowledge of Nagash, had a prophecy of a silent world covered in nothing but bones ruled by the dead. Problem was, of course, that no living people meant no blood, and so Wasoran substituted it with so much dark magic that the need to feed just went away. This does does have a downside, however, in that their bodies become so desiccated that there is absolutely no hiding what you're looking at. Amongst vampires, they're the frailest of the bunch, and there's no hiding amongst mortals for these people. There's also the side effect that that much concentrated dark magic surrounding a person tends to drive them mad, vampire or not, and so Wasoran's apprentice Melchior actually ate Wasoran in his madness, causing the rest of the bloodline to scatter. Nowadays, they're a largely solitary bunch, finding remote areas to build an evil wizard tower and study their dark arts in, away from the prying eyes of everyone else. The Necrorks, in their attempt to bring about Wasoran's vision, are a slow and steady bunch. They also take decades and centuries to bring their plots to fruition, like the Lamians, but that's more so a pacing thing rather than the Illuminati thing. When Morslieb is high in the sky, when Gehamisnacht comes around, the Necrorks blight the land surrounding them with dark magic, rendering it a lifeless wasteland. 1 acre at a time do they intend to bring about the land of the dead, and while they have an entire planet to go through, vampires are immortal. If anything's on their side, it's time. End times notwithstanding. They do so in isolation due to their deep-seated paranoia, rarely making new Necrarchs and only finding company in still-living necromancers, madmen, and the occasional mutant. When they do go to war, the Necrarchs have an abundance of the lower and higher ends of the vampire roster. Since they're so good with magic, they can easily raise thousands of corpses at a moment's notice. For the same reason, they'll also have a lot of zombie dragons and terrorgeists to call upon. What would be an incredibly taxing endeavor for another vampire is just a few moments of moderate strain for a Necrarch, and so the armies of them contain both the hammer and the anvil whenever they march to claim some magic tome or other nerd crap like that. In their off time, aside from slowly corrupting the land, they like to do general research into the dark arts, discovering new spells, new ways to use existing ones, that sort of evil wizard deal. This makes them the second most likely group of wizards behind Tzeentch sorcerers to know some of the real creative spells for anyone who really wants to mess with their roleplay players. You can't always use that spell that makes people laugh to death, but you can also hit them with the old 1-2 buckle their shoe and have a Necrarch cast Obliterate Prostate on some overeager Averlander player. They'll sell their research to other bloodlines as well, the price of which can be anything from gold for underhanded deals with mortals to special artifacts. Or sacrifices. There's probably a lot of unwilling participants in these transactions, to be honest. Overall, take the Thousand Sons. Now remove all the pathetic and make them vampires. Now you have a Necrarch, and I have to say I much prefer this version. No Necrarch has ever hit me with a turn one soul ring, Magnus. The second to last bloodline are the Blood Dragons. They come from Abharash, who was a real cool dude and one of the two original Trueborn who wasn't a raging asshole most of the time. When the rest of them got together for a bit of a pissing match, he just didn't bother to show up. He was only tempted by Neferata into taking the potion to allow him to become the perfect warrior, and when shit hit the fan, he wasn't having any of the other vampire shenanigans. He wandered the world, refusing to feed upon those who were weak, instead only feasting upon worthy opponents. Now in his quest to find those opponents, he did kill plenty of those who were weak, such as entire dwarf mining operations, but he also raged through chaos war bands and orc tribes, so I guess that balances out a little bit. Eventually, he would find the ultimate opponent he so craved in a dragon at the World's Edge Mountains. Because he's a badass, he managed to kill it and drink its blood, and with that, he ascended past his need to feed. The dragon's blood was so potent that the thirst was gone. In fact, aside from not casting a shadow, all of his vampiric weaknesses were gone. Since then, he's wandered the world, always seeking mighty opponents and refusing to serve anyone, much like another cool undead guy. It's a shame he and Gotrek never fought, because that would have been a hell of a battle. But despite being the progenitor of the bloodline, he was not the one to give it the name. That instead came from his own vampiric spawn, and indeed the second most famous blood dragon, Wallach Harkon. There was once a knightly order of the Empire known as the Order of the Blood Dragon. Wallach Harkon one night descended upon their keep and demanded entrance into it. When they for some reason let him in, he proceeded to challenge all of them to single combat. This went as well for the Order as you'd expect, fighting a vampire sired and trained by one of the single deadliest combatants in fantasy's history. But after he had butchered his way through the entire keep, he granted the blood kiss to those who had fought with bravery and honor. To those that didn't, or those that just didn't meet the cut, they were the feast to mark the rebirth of the Blood Dragons not as a knightly order, but as a vampire bloodline. Their name was slightly changed after they became vampires, both in honor of Abharash's mighty deed and because their former name was basically the same thing. A bit late into the video, but on future rewatches, take a shot every time I say the word blood or bloodline. Don't actually do that, you're gonna die. For some time, the Blood Dragons would remain in this keep, but decades later, witch hunters would discover it and lay siege with the armies of Reichland, Wiesenland, and several knightly orders, no doubt seeking to cleanse the filth that had taken one of their fellow orders. They were successful despite heavy casualties in reclaiming the keep, but enough Blood Dragons had escaped that the bloodline would forever plague the world. Nowadays, the Blood Dragons roam the land, seeking greater challenges to bring them to greater heights. Sometimes they lead armies, but oftentimes they group together in a unit as part of a greater vampiric force. As the honorable warrior archetype, they seek out worthy fights and tend to leave the weak alone for not being worth the trouble. The lore will oftentimes say that their honor is just disguising the fact that they aren't any better than the rest of their undead kin, which is something that varies from vampire to vampire. You can get blood dragons that pretend to be honorable and chivalrous, and then when no one's looking, they chow down at a Nordland orphanage. But you also get ones that do genuinely try to avoid feasting on the weak and actually are honorable combatants. Your mileage may vary, but just about all of them will revere Abharash and try to follow in his footsteps. Not being Abharash, most of them die before they get to the dragon, and the rest die at that point, but God bless them for trying. They tend to look down on the rest of the bloodlines for a variety of reasons. The Lamians are sneaky and dishonorable, the Strigoi are mindless beasts only worthy as prey to hunt, the Von Karsteins are arrogant pricks, and the Necrarchs are lame nerds. But given their status as a proper unit in the Vampire Count's army, I feel fairly confident in saying that they're the most willing to work with other bloodlines, even if only for the opportunity to fight worthy opponents. The Blood Dragons actually managed to sneak their way into Age of Sigmar as the Blood Knight's kid, whose own history is kind of funny. Blood Knights aren't necessarily all blood dragons, but who cares, they're blood dragons. Back in fantasy, they were some of the single deadliest models in the game, and in Age of Sigmar, they can still wreak some havoc. As for their kit, the funny part comes from how much of a joke the pricing was. GW thought it would be real goofy to stick a $100 price tag on a kit of 5 models. You could get 8 Bretonian Knights at this point in time for around $40, mind you. Thankfully, they not only updated the kit, but brought it down to $70, which is far closer to normal GW overpriced standards. Still though, what the hell was that for a bit? I mean, I know what it was them charging a lot for a good unit, but still, that much overpricing is insane. And finally, we come to the Strigoi. Every group of something has to have the runt of the litter, and in this case, it's these guys. Their progenitor is Usharan, a man who you can't help but feel bad for the entirety of his history. Depending on the lore, he was either withheld the Trueborn Elixir for no other reason than Neferana wanted to look down on him, and his recreation of it turned him into a monster, or she did give it to him, but he was cursed after the fact. Either way, it was a rough early start for Usharan. After Lamia was destroyed, he wandered into the kingdom of Strigos. It was a vampire kingdom run by a fella named Kadan, who was leaning a bit too hard on the rampant overfeeding and Nagash worship that doomed Lamia. He overthrew Kadan and halted these policies, removing worship of Nagash and only feeding on criminals. It went so well that even the non-vampiric subjects of the realm respected Usharan for his work. He was so generous that he went as far as to invite the other trueborn vampires to the kingdom, saying they could live in the luxury they once did, only now totally free of Nagash's influence. Naturally, Neferata got jealous and tried to burn everything down. Her vampiric forces and minions were stopped, but the kingdom was weakened, and since this all happened in the Badlands, the greenest and meanest fellows took advantage while Usharan was busy fighting Neferata. Orcs ransacked the weakened kingdom, and the survivors fled. Every time they approached another kind of vampire, they were cast aside or killed outright. They were forced to hide in dark and horrible places, the only company willing to accept them that of the ghouls of the world. The surviving mortal followers of them became the Strigani, and they varied between doing the Strigoi's bidding in the shadows and just trying to make a living on the road. They're also persecuted by everyone else, too. No rest for the wicked and all that. Perhaps most tragic of this whole mess is the relations they have with the Blood Dragons. They view the Strigoi as at best prey to hunt, like I said, but Abharash himself defended Strigos when it was besieged on all sides. It was one last chance for the vampires to be more than the pathetic, parasitic creatures they are, and Neferata and the rest of her ilk ruined it. The Strigoi are all a little bit stir-crazy from the fate that befell them, both out of a sort of PTSD and the more active issue of them being hunted by their vampiric brethren and mortals alike. A lot of them remember the good thing they had going and spend a lot of time wallowing in sorrow over it. Some of them basically slip into depression, doing nothing but relive old battles and glories all their lives. Others are more actively insane, speaking with friends long dead and acting like they're feral animals. But don't mistake them for being actually feral, at least not like the degenerate vampires that are Vargeists. Strigoi are cunning and intelligent, and I mean truly cunning, not orc cunning. Magic is not a forgotten art to them, and from Usharan they've inherited their incredible strength. Furthering it is that they don't pretend to still be some kind of human. The honor of the Blood Dragons, the Lamian scheming, the nobility of the Von Karsteins or the Necrarch's research, none of that matters to them. They're intelligent beasts that rule the night as is their birthright. And for all that the other vampires look down on them, they know damn well that in the 1v1 they need to be extraordinarily careful. The Strigoi can take a remarkable remarkable amount of punishment before they go down. Meanwhile, if another vampire makes the slightest mistake, the hulking Strigoi will give them the true death they so deserve. They're not slow-hulking tanks, either. Their massive bulk hides a speed as deadly as any Lamian. Any army a Strigoi can muster up will be similarly brutal. While, of course, there can be zombies and skeletons, hordes of ghouls and crypt horrors will descend alongside their Strigoi overlords. Those monsters may be completely unintelligent, they may be looked down upon by other vampires, and hell, they may not even be actual undead. But when led by a Strigoi, they can wreak havoc, and everyone longs for the day they can not only reclaim their lost kingdom, but pay the rest of the vampires of Warhammer back for thousands of years of suffering that they caused Usharan's children. Insane, depressed, and with bitter memories as long as any dwarfs, the Strigoi are a force to be reckoned with. And by and large, those are the vampires of Warhammer. There are actually a few other ones, but they're not really worth getting into. The Jade-Blooded, for instance, come from Neferata potentially sending some of the vampire potion over to Cathay, but because the origins of the vampires went through the goddamn ringer of retcons, they're only debatably real. Also, they, to my knowledge, haven't been mentioned too much with Cathay's new lore, aside from a minor vampire faction there in Total Warhammer 3, which itself is likely to stay at being a small nod to old canon rather than a basis for a whole new DLC. It'd be cool for me to be wrong, but I imagine other things are taking priority. Or the Madmasi, who are even less worth getting into. They were another bloodline, they might have lived in Indon Koresh, and they might have had an insect theme going on about them. All of this is might, because if my reading is correct, they didn't even make it into a source book or anything like that. Cool ideas in both cases, but not to me something worth going into at this moment. Thank you as always to my wonderful channel members. You are the blood dragons to my vampire counts, the noblest of souls charging headfirst with me into this mess we call YouTube. If you'd like to support the channel, feel free to subscribe or become a member. Either way, thank you for watching and take care out there. It's an interesting contrast now that I'm thinking about it. Strigoi and Sterland are both underdogs in their own factions that have two syllables in their name and start with S. The cards are completely against them, but they still persist. And yet with the Strigoi, I'm rooting for them. They tried as hard as vampires could to do right and live as peacefully as possible with mortals on a large scale. Meanwhile, I hope Sterlanders get kicked in the ribs by a Strigoi. Curious, isn't that?